Good evening. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear as a co-net control, John, KC2WGB. And at this time, we run the TechNet. John and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic crew that meets here to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio and all the things connected to it. Ham radio operators are interested in a whole lot of things, so sometimes the subjects get a little bit more into science than ham radio, but we feel that that's related. During the first hour, John and I accept people who check in with their name and call letters, by which we go down that list, and within the first hour we make a sincere effort that everybody gets answered, at least a brief answer. At the end of that hour, John tonight is going to be giving us a bit of a lecture. He'll be telling us a little bit about that in a minute. Also, we go to the mailbag, which used to be called Mel's Corner. It's now called John's Corner by me, by which amateur radio operators who don't yet have their license don't get a chance to directly address us on vocally on this particular net. They can do it by way of email, snail mail, and they get their questions answered that way. We also will have Paul, the WS2NR space expert, going to tell us the latest on what's going on with Curiosity. And Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory that landed 2 weeks ago, is doing a very good job. Looks very encouraging. You may or may not know that the indentations on the wheels in Morse code trace out JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So, quite a machine. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins. Give me your call letters and name in that order, and the word yes, which means you do have a question.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And we should periodically, at least once every minute, give an interruption until all four beeps take place so that a person out of the area who wants to use Echolink or IRLP gets a chance to check in. Questions and what I'm saying is that the call letters and name for those who really do have a question or a comment, you need that sign in just because you're listening. This is 29 years. This is in TechNet number 1413. By now, we assume somebody in the tri-state area is listening, and that's what we try to tap into. This repeater has moderately good coverage of northern New Jersey, southern New York State, eastern Connecticut, quite a bit of Long Island, and there's a lot of brain power in that metropolitan New York City area, and we try to tap into that. Hopefully, people who hear us discussing a particular subject will chime in and say, and give us the wisdom of their particular experience and training. We don't promise that everything you hear the first time is going to be perfectly accurate. Nobody bats a thousand. There are errors that occur occasionally. But by way of the peer review of people listening, or listening to the recordings, and you can listen to the last 6.5 years worth of recordings by going to the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that website, and the last 6 years of TechNets are recorded, and some of them are even documented as to what subject is being discussed each 5 minutes or so. By way of those recordings, and by way of people listening to various people say on this TechNet, we eventually get feedback if there's an error, and we get a chance to correct those errors. So at this time, I'm going to take your call letters and name. If you've got a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name. A typical sign-in would sound like this, AC2AJ, Brian. And yes, let's see who we got out there, K2RAW listening.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KB2MAR, Gabe, yes.
Okay, we got you, Gabe. Anyone else?
AC2AJ, Brian, no.
N2RDB, Tim, yes, an update on my antenna project.
To Meatball, no.
Delta Echo Alpha Mobile, Ray, no.
Tim, was that N2 Romeo Delta Bravo, if I got that right, Tim?
That is correct. November 2, Romeo Delta Bravo.
Okay, Barry, we heard. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters right now.
Whiskey 2 Delta.
is off the pole.
Okay, now, I missed some of those. Whiskey 2 Delta Echo Oscar, tell me your name, sir.
Whiskey 2 Delta Echo Alpha, name is Ray. Just reporting to that, John.
Okay, we got you, Ray. Ray, you do have a question or a comment for the net?
Negative, just wants to jump in. I remember you telling me you toasted the net, and I want to jump in and say hello and show his support.
Okay, very fine, Ray. Who signed in after Ray? Wes, we heard you, but who signed in after Ray?
2EJ, Doug, yes.
Okay, I heard EJ and Doug. Would you like to give me the rest of that, Doug?
Yes, I do have a question.
Doug, can you give me your full call letters? All I heard was EJ and Doug. Please give me the rest of your call.
November 2, Echo, Juliet.
Okay, we've got you, Ray. Alrighty. So far, with people with real questions and comments are Gabe, Tim, and Doug. Anyone else?
KC2WGB with a question also.
And, yeah, yes, with a question if there's time.
Okay, John, I heard yes with a question if there's time. Please give me your call letters and name.
Okay, Dick, that was me, Ray, Kilo Charlie 2, Mike, Yankee, if there's time.
We're going to try to squeeze you in, Ray. So I think Ray does have a real question or a comment. Okay. And John, we've got two. We got more than enough to get started. Gabe, KB2MAR, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW, KB2MAR. My question regarding a current surge limiter. Generally, how do they work? What's the amperage required? Let's say if something draws about 10 amps, would I get a 15 amp current surge limiter? Do they work on some kind of an inductive, reactive type of thing? This may be 2MAR back to that.
Okay, that's a new one on me. Current surge limiter. I should know what that is, but I don't. Is this a box that you plug into the wall and then you plug your appliance into it? Is it something that's on the printed circuit board of a piece of electronics? Give me a couple of words on this one, Gabe.
Charlie, inrush current limiter is what he meant, I believe.
Line conditioner.
Gag conditioner.
Okay, if it's a line conditioner, Gabe, tell us what this thing looks like. Give us a brand name. How expensive? Give us a few more words.
Well, basically, it's a device that limits inrushing current to, let's say, an air conditioner or a large refrigerator. What it does is basically the electrical company in this area, Westchester County, has a different, in southern Westchester County, has a system where when something draws a lot of current all at once, your electric bill gets... You just get charged per kilowatt hour. You get charged by the current surge. So what this device does is it limits the current. It makes the current come up at a gradual rate. And that's what this, I don't know the brand name of it. That's why I'm asking on the TechNet. See if anyone can recommend one to me. Back to you.
Well, I see a definite problem with that one, Gabe. In the case of a air conditioner, say, for instance, one of these wall-type air conditioners, which maybe draws 14 amperes if it's running on 110, and it could be running on 220, but draws very close to the circuit breaker current or the fuse current on startup. Many air conditioners do that. And if you did do something to limit that current on startup of an air conditioner, there's a moderately good chance that it will just sit there and hum in locked rotor mode and not start up at all. So in the case of an air conditioner, you've got to be able to tolerate that inrush current when it starts up, particularly if it's been running and it intermittently stops and then has to start again. So I can see a definite problem of using one of those on an air conditioner. Something like a refrigerator, which draws a hell of a lot less current, I don't think it's needed. And I think you're saying that your particular electric company will charge you a premium if your inrush current is high. I'm having trouble believing that one. In other words, there's lots of appliances. If, for instance, I was running a incandescent light bulb, a very large one, a 1,000-watt, outdoor lighting type incandescent light bulb, because the filament resistance is 1/10 of the normal running current, it's going to draw 10 times normal current. Now, limiting the inrush current on a filament and starting up the filament slowly, no problem. I can see an advantage in doing that. Life of the filament and also limiting inrush current. But certain things that have a critical starting phenomena, like an air conditioner, I see a problem. Now, who is it? I guess it was John that you seem to have some familiarity with line conditioners, current limiters, and so on. So let's see what you know about this one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
And also KC2J.
We're going to go to Eric right after John. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, I see a problem with that under those heavy loads, drawing current. But what he's claiming is they have demand meters. Now, regular kilowatt-hour meters will not pick that up. It has to be a demand meter, and it has a multiplier in it. Now, I don't think they would bother putting a demand meter in a regular house. Commercial property? Absolutely, especially if you have over 7 horsepower running. So it doesn't sound practical to use that on an air conditioner or a refrigerator. They do have soft start kits and things like that, but they're designed for that particular compressor or that particular motor. But I think there's an error there somewhere. Let's see what Eric has to say. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm with you, John. I know that my air conditioner, when it first starts up, the window air conditioner when I had one, if I didn't have very healthy wiring in the house so that it could take that inrush current and not drop below 90 volts, let me say, and there was a chance it would just sit there and hum in the locked rotor mode and never get a chance to start. I've had air conditioners that'll do that. So any kind of an inrush current limiting device in that case would hamper my ability to start up that particular air conditioner. Now, you've got some really heavy drain devices in your transmitters, Eric, for channel 21 and channel 13. So maybe you have familiarity with these things. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Now, I agree with John in terms of for the home consumer, they're not going to put a demand 1 hour meter in. But, like, throughout the state of Florida, they have something called load monitoring. And depending upon what's going on in the network, they will, in essence, if you have a full pump or you have an air conditioner, the way it's wired, it won't shut the fan off, but it will turn the compressor off at given periods of time when load and demand requires that they spread the load around, so to speak. So they have a little box in there which essentially, let's not call it carrier current, let's not quite call it what we worried about, internet over power lines, but it's a similar type of setup. That's used throughout the state of Florida. But what's going on in New York, let me drop for a second. As we begin to do smart metering, as we start to build what we're going to call the smart grid, and as the manufacturers also come online with smart grid type products, what will happen is, for example, your dryer, depending upon what loads and what demands are going on, it'll run the motor on the dryer, and it will intermittently turn the heating element on and off. Well, same thing for water heaters. So as a precursor to some of the smart grids, they're beginning to put some of the electronics on the, but some electric companies are beginning now to utilize these devices, which have some form of communication. It's kind of like Ethernet over power line, but they're kind of being careful about that because of all the hubbub that happened with that. But I think what you're seeing is a precursor of what's becoming a smart grid going online in various different smaller power companies, and also some larger power companies are doing pilot projects. So, K2RIWK, good day.
Now, because I was doing something else and not completely paying attention, you may have already addressed this, but once again, do you believe this kind of instrumentation is about to be placed on private homes as opposed to businesses like yours? Back to you, Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW.
Demand meters, no. But power consumption meters, yeah, that report back to, let's call it, the beginnings of the smart grid. Yes, actually, throughout Florida, there are a number of electric companies, which are actually cooperative. They do low demand monitoring, and they will turn non-essential stuff off on you. The way they require you hook up your air conditioners is that your fan will go to one part of the 220 line, you know, 110 line. The compressor will go to another, but the compressor will be connected through the low demand monitoring device, which is basically a relay that turns the compressor on and off.
AC2IS.
Okay, Eric. Also, very good information. AC2IF, I think it was India Foxtrot. If you've got information on the subject, please come forward and start off with your name, sir. K2RAW, my name is Dick.
This is Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra, Bill. Just commenting that it seems more likely that a power company would be upset about an inductive load, and that there might be a device that would make an inductive load look closer to a resistive load.
Yeah, that's called a capacitor. In the case of a very large factory, Bill, where you might be running a whole lot of inductive load rotary machinery, punch presses and lathes and things like that, you can correct the fact that the phase angle is significant and inductive by putting properly chosen, properly sized shunt capacitors across the line. Hopefully near the actual machine itself, but sometimes at some central place in the factory. I think it was Glenn, KC2QIQ, has worked on line conditioners, this kinds of adaptive circuitry, which will continuously adapt for what is the phase angle or power factor of your particular factory. So I think there's companies building things like that. Glad to hear from you, Bill, and you're sounding good tonight. Out of curiosity, what are you using for an antenna? Is it at home, or is it a mobile location that you're at? Over there for a quick one to you, Bill. AC2IS, K2RIW.
I'm at my home location right now with Waxon radio, HT, 5 watts, with a diamond antenna on it, not the factory antenna, going after my local line mark repeater over here.
Now I understand. All right, you're signing into the Eastern input. And that external antenna, is it on top of the building that you live in, Bill?
Sorry, the antenna on my radio, that's it's just a rubber ducky right on top of the HD.
So in other words, you said diamond, and now you said rubber duck. I'm not sure what antenna you're using and where it's located. Back to you on that one, Bill.
SRJ77DA diamond antenna to replacement for the factory antenna that comes with the Waxon.
Okay. Glad you're getting through rather nicely. And if you haven't already, when you do put an antenna on top of the building, particularly if it's a Yagi antenna, you can aim in the right direction. You're going to be pleasantly surprised. Okay, so I guess we've got some of the information you're looking for, Gabe. And are you about to purchase something? Is that what's about going on here? KB2MAR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KSL, it's a 12,000 BTU air conditioner. And like you're telling me about this current surge situation with the compressor, being that it's going to require a lot of inrush current to get it going, it doesn't make sense in that situation. I did hear people using it for refrigerators, though. These things are sort of at the Home Depot, by the way, called the current surge limiter. I don't know the brand name of these devices, but I know that they're sold at Home Depot. And I've heard rumors down at Southern Westchester where if you have a high inrush of current, every time we turn on like a high draw current device, they charge you extra money. The electric company, like Con Ed, charges you more for that situation. So you're better off just leaving the AC unit on continuously rather than having on and off several times, or having the thermostat make the compressor cycle on and off. KB2, I'm going to go back to that.
May I have a comment?
Okay, Wes. Wes, if you've got knowledge on this, give us a brief comment on that.
Well, basically, inrush current limiter is being used to avoid damage to components and tripping the supply fuse of the circuit breaker. What they do is that they use the thermistors, which have the negative temperature coefficient and the fixed resistors, to limit inrush current. That's one of the way of doing that. The other way would be, if you want to, there is something being called MET glass power light. Basically, it's based on the C-cord, and it's a power factor correction inductor designed for switch mode power supplies. But they use it as well for the air conditions. Now, I would say it's kind of questionable, but there is a nice article on it. If you go to www.medglass.com, MedGlass will be by GLAS, so MedGLAS.com, and yeah, you would be able to see that. Enter it here.
Okay, thank you for that website, Wes. The early television sets that used to have all of the filaments in series used to have something called the Bolo resistor or bolometer resistor. It was a negative coefficient, temperature coefficient resistor that was in series with all of the filaments that were in series, so that when you first turned on the television set, so you didn't get a high inrush current and therefore drastically thermally stress the filaments of those tubes, that resistor would start off with a high resistance, heat up, and go to a slow resistance. And so the television set would take a full 60 seconds to come on full speed, so to speak, but that was a nice component that used to be used. However, it was a high failure item. After about 2 years of use, variable resistor would take longer and longer to come down to a small number of ohms, and eventually it never made it, and the set never fully came on. So that was a frequently replaced item.
That is interesting, because maybe in America, not in Russia, I've been dealing with that for many years, since the early childhood, and I've seen only few, quite few, maybe four, maybe five TVs around that were suffering this kind of damage.
Yeah, these were the very early television sets in the 1950 to 1955 vintage year. Pretty soon they abandoned that approach. Admiral was one of them that was doing it. So people who are back in the days of television repair in the old days were ran into these things. But to take that technique, which is putting 100 watts of filament power into a television set, and to run it for thousands of watt appliances in the house, I'm having trouble believing that that would be reliable. So as you look into this more, Gabe, and as you find out about these things, please come back and let us know what you find out. One quick question to you, Gabe, is the one that's being sold by Home Depot, roughly how many dollars for how many watts? KB2MAR, K2RIW.
Okay, devices sold at Home Depot are not very, very expensive. They come in different amperages. Now, I don't know the brand name of these devices, but I know that Home Depot sells them. These are sold in 5, 10, and 15 amp increments. And basically what they do is they plug them into the wall. I think it's a wall wart style device, where you plug the device into the wall and then plug your equipment into that device. Maybe a higher current one maybe sits on the ground, and then you plug the other end into the wall, and then you plug the device into the box on the ground. I couldn't tell you that, but these devices are still at Home Depot, and I was wondering how they worked. And if you guys are telling me it makes sense, it wouldn't be right to use it for a compressor, because a compressor requires a lot of inrush current to get it going. It might work on the principle of inductive reactance, is probably a choke and a coil of wire wrapped around it. What happens is, as you guys know, when there's a big demand of current, this back EMF, so to speak, will prevent an increase in current happening all at once. KB2MAR, back to next.
Yeah, but once again, Gabe, no matter which size you're talking about, roughly how many dollars for this device at Home Depot?
I'd say between $10 and $30.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. That gives me some idea of how elaborate could the circuitry be inside. So, please come back and let us know what you find out as you discover more about this. The next guy on the list was Tim, N2 Romeo Delta Bravo. Go right ahead with your question, Tim. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment on the previous.
Okay, stand by a minute, Tim. Go ahead, John.
Dick, you brought up a very interesting point, which may have been missed, that when you start that and the compressors under high head conditions, you could have a major problem with that compressor trying to start it at that reduced current. It's not gonna go, but it will get warm. Just wanted to make that clear. KC2WGB.
I 100% agree with you, John. To limit inrush surge current on a wall-type air conditioner, and maybe even a full house-type air conditioner, I think that is undesirable. I think you need that inrush current, because at the instant you power up your air conditioner and its contactor closes and applies the full 110 or 220 volts to that motor, at that instant the motor is in the locked rotor condition. It hasn't started turning yet, and it's going to draw a heap of current, and it has to in order to get rolling. And particularly if the air conditioner has been running, and that was one of its 5-minute interrupts, so to speak, you've already still got some of the Freon in the cold state, and it requires extra surge current to get that going. So I'd be very reluctant to use one of these on an air conditioner. I think the air conditioner has to tolerate that inrush current in order to make sure it starts, because if it doesn't start, it sits there with power on in the locked rotor mode, humming, making a loud sound, and then it's eventually the thermal switch inside will eventually trip, but you don't want to use that thermal switch very often. It's got a finite number of operations before it fails. And to have a great big expensive air conditioner fail because a switch buried inside that sealed motor has been worn out by multiple cycling, that's an awful expensive failure of a very cheap part that is unreplaceable, if you know what I mean, without replacing the whole darn compressor and air conditioner. So I'd go slow on that one. Tim, N2, Romeo, Delta, Bravo.
KC2, QAQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
From my understanding, Dick, a lot of the new air conditioners that are out there already have the current surge protection already built into them. And, many of them are like devices I designed about 10 years ago, where we limited the input surge current to motors, generators, compressors, compressor motors, and how we did it was with pulse width modulation, where we allowed the 60 cycles to basically charge an inverter, and then we had a synchronized 60 cycle inverter where the 60 cycles was actually starting off at, you know, less than 5% duty cycle, and then we worked the duty cycle wider with time. And the advantage to that is that you can allow the high peak currents but at very, very low duty cycles. And then as the duty cycle increases, the power increases, but the power line can't tell the difference. It just sees the current building slowly. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
If the compressor motor of an air conditioner was specifically designed in that way, I'm going to agree with you. But if you just take an ordinary air conditioner, and if you do anything by pulse width modulation and whatever you're describing right now, if you do anything to limit the current when it's trying to start up, I think there's a higher probability it will sit there in the locked rotor mode. I've been there. I had a window type air conditioner I installed in the rental house that I was living in Smithtown. The wiring in the house was probably a 14 gauge wire, and it was a 15 ampere circuit, and the air conditioner probably drew 13 amperes when it was...
Dick, how many years ago was this?
Lots of years ago. I think this was way back in, 1968 or so. So are you telling me the air conditioners have been redesigned since then? This is a window-type air conditioner, and because of the wiring resistance of that particular house, there was a significant number of times when that air conditioner had a lot of trouble starting, particularly if a partial brownout was taking place, where the line voltage was not 118, but it was 107. There's a high probability that air conditioner would not start. It would sit there and hum, and if I didn't go turn it off, I would be doing damage to it. So have they made specific design changes since then, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW?
Okay, if you're adjusting.
Yeah, Eric is recognized. You know, definitely, Dick. I mean, at least for certain, the last 10 years, probably more. The air conditioners have been redesigned to have much higher efficiency. They've changed the type of freon that they use. The control, the power factor correction has to be added. Surge protection has to be added. Yeah, there's been a lot of improvements in air conditioners in the last at least minimum of 10 years. I'm thinking maybe even quite a bit more than 10, Dick. But back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ, and Eric was in there as well.
Okay, so maybe the newer ones act differently than the one that I owned at that time. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
All right, well, I sort of agree with Glenn in terms of what's going on with air conditioner design. For example, when you see a mini split, so you see the unit on the outside. For example, I bought mine and installed mine, which is a what they call it, an inverter type compressor. Really, you can think of it as a stepper motor. It's got a bunch of switching transistors on it. And what it will do, like on mine, depending on how much load I ask for it, because I have an evaporator in each room, if I'm only using one, I mean, it's a 36,000 BTU compressor. But if I'm only using 6,000 BTU, that's all that the compressor is going to work on. The amount of current that it draws, and it's a switcher, and it operates on a series of choppers that run it. The small, cheap Japanese or Chinese-made air conditioners, 3,000-5,000 BTUs, it's still a regular old compressor motor, although it's required that they use 410A for the refrigerant, which actually is a little tougher on the compressor, believe it or not, because it operates at higher pressures. Low side of 410A can be as high as 350 pounds per square inch. High side can be 500 pounds per square inch, as opposed to 322, which is one heck of a lot lower. So, cheap and dirty window air conditioning unit, pretty much the same technology, although there's been improvements in manufacturing compressors and the bearings, the way it's organized, so it has a little bit less friction, draws a little bit less current. Working a little harder in terms of startup, but more efficient in operation, especially with 410A as a refrigerant. It's a little more efficient. Most people don't realize that 410A is actually a mixture of two different freons. They're non-fluorocarbon type freons, so they don't affect the ozone. And interestingly enough, I'm going to drop. Traditionally, in an I-22 or an I-12 type system, you put gas in on the low side. With the new refrigerants, including in the cars, 135A, they're mixtures. You actually have to put them in liquid, which means that you're really going to go high side on it. And when you do specific heat tests, know that you put enough stuff in there, you wind up doing peak maximum loads with the air conditioning system. So, the more modern air conditioning systems, like the mini splits or some of the newer ducted systems that were in the house, most of them are inverter type compressors, which you can think of it as a stepper motor because it's chopped and it's duty cycle driven, and there's a whole bunch of electronics that go with it. They can operate very efficiently, and they can actually ramp their load up from very small to very big. Even if you have a high demand all at once, it will start and bring that compressor up to speed rather slowly based upon load. So, K2RIW, K2J.
Very interesting. Now, the thing that sounds a little bit crazy is you said you now load in freon, or the freon-like material, on the high side. when you read any of the manuals on doing air conditioner repair, refurbishment, whatever, they give you lots and lots of warnings to make sure you do not open the valve on the high side to come back to the can of Freon in your hand, because that extra pressure could possibly explode that can. You have to make sure you're loading it into the low side. And if these new Freon materials run at even higher pressure without using some kind of an external pump, how in the world would I get it into the high side, Eric? And why are you not loading into the low side? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
These types of 410A systems, depending upon which ones you have, some of them have a loading valve, another valve which shuts the compressor side off of the loop. You go in liquid, okay? Going in liquid on the low side in an operating system is not really a good idea either. So, depending upon the manufacturer, there's a number of different ways in which they do it. Some of them requires that the system be shut off. Some of them require that they have the load valve, which is actually a four-way valve, which changes the way the connection is made to the condenser and the evaporator and the expansion valve. So, read up on 410A, and you'll find a lot of different, interesting ways of approaching it.
Now, if I was loading 410A in, and if I was an old-fashioned guy, and I let it boil off from my can in my hand into the low side of the system, are you saying it wouldn't go in, Eric? Go ahead.
If you were an old-fashioned guy and you had the can standing upright like you normally would, you would actually wind up with an improper balance of refrigerant and things won't work right because it won't have the correct mixture of the two Freons.
I'm catching on. In the can, they boil off at different temperatures, so therefore I'll be putting in the wrong mixture. And that's why it's got to go in as a liquid. And the liquid cannot go onto the low side because the compressor cannot compress a liquid. And it's got to go into the high side. Okay, I'm catching on. Very educational. Thank you, Eric. Okay, we're going to move on. Tim, N2RDB. You better grab it before somebody else does, Tim. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, you sure about that? This is N2RDB. Anyway, I was on the net a few weeks ago, actually quite a number of weeks ago, discussing a project that I was building involving two pair of hamstick type antennas mounted as a pair of dipoles. I had mentioned on the net that there was a problem, that the 40 meter pair was tuning up just fine. And the 80-meter pair, no matter how much I shorten the whips, the SWR, the sweet spot, if you will, would actually come up higher and higher as I brought them in farther. Well, it turns out that the original hamstick antennas, basically the steel whip slides into a metal collar on the antenna, and there are set screws to be tightened. I'll let it drop a moment. Now, the Jetstream brand antennas that I bought at the last Limark Ham Fair, that method has been modified. The steel whips actually slide into a metal ferrule, and you tighten the set screws on the ferrule, and this ferrule then screws into the base portion or the loaded inductor portion of the antenna. Now, the problem arises when you pull the whips too far inward, when you shorten them up too much. You can slide them inside the base portion of the antenna, but only to a certain point. Beyond that certain point, they begin to act as a capacitive stub. And I did go to the website you recommended, and I read your writings, and it basically gave me a lot of insight as to the nature of what I was working with. I'll let it drop a moment. So, on the 80-meter whips, you actually do have to, on the 80-meter antennas, you actually have to shorten the whip. You actually have to physically cut a portion of it off to get over that capacitive stub problem. You might recall I had mentioned that they were behaving much as a bandpass filter that I had recently tuned at work. Well, that too had way too much capacitance. And I had to actually physically go in and change the way the strip line was running inside the can to get around that problem. Anyway, the project is what I would call a limited success. I'll let it drop a moment. I had started tuning up each pair of whips separately. I had bought two mounting brackets to convert the pair of hamsticks into dipoles, and I tuned up the 40-meter pair, and basically you have a 2-to-1 Vizoir bandwidth over, I would have to say, about 2/3 of the voice portion of 40 meters, basically about 180, 200 kilohertz, which is slightly better than expected. The 80-meter pair has a significantly narrower 2-to-1 Vizoir bandwidth. You're talking about 30 kc max on that. I did tune them up separately, and when they worked, I mounted them both to this metal bar that I had, and I had created a basically a small harness out of number 8 electrical wire to connect the hot side together on each pair, and the metal bar acted as the connection for the other half, and they do actually work when hooked together in this matter. So I just thought I would share that with the net. This is N2RDB.
Now, if I understand correctly, what you're attempting to do here, Gabe, is to correction Tim, is to take these hamstick antennas, which are a spirally wound ground plane-like thing, quite a bit more compact than the full quarter wave ground plane, and by running them a pair back-to-back, you end up with a dipole that physically is quite a bit shorter than the 132 feet that an 80-meter dipole would be. When you finish doing this, were you using 80-meter hamsticks or 40-meter hamsticks? That's not clear, because you kept saying 40 meters, but you're using them on 80 meters. And what was, in the case of 80 meters, and yes, I know it's going to be narrowband, because anything you do to physically shorten an antenna is going to make it more narrowband. That's physics. That's the true Wheeler criteria, if you want to be exact. They wrote a bunch of articles in 1948 about electrically small antennas, Mr. Chu and Mr. Wheeler. So how much the Q goes up and the bandwidth goes down is mathematically very predictable by those early articles. So what was the physical length of this 80-meter dipole when you finished it, Gabe? N2RD, sorry about that, Tim, N2RDB, K2RIW?
To clarify, we are talking about two pair of dipoles, not one pair. We're talking about two pair of hamstick antennas. I bought a pair for 40 and a pair for, I've been saying 80, it's actually 75 meters. And I tuned each pair up as a dipole separately. In other words, I had bought two of the mounting brackets to make two single hamstick antennas into a dipole. I made one pair for 40 meters and one pair for actually the upper portion of 75 meters. Now, I have two separate hamstick dipoles, one for 75 and one for 40. I mounted both of them to a metal bar, and I had provided a piece of number 8 electrical wire to complete the other half of the circuit path. These dipoles are in parallel, and the approximate length, the approximate spread of these things is about 15, 16 feet.
I think you've got a very nice article there. I think you've got the hamstick equivalent of a fan dipole for 80 and 40 meters, 75 and 40 meters. and 15 feet. Is that the tip-to-tip distance on 75 meters? 15 feet, is that what you're saying? If so, that's one hell of a compaction. That's what it sounds like you're saying, but I'm going to run it back to you, Tim, for a repeat on that one. You got it, Tim.
Yes, that is correct. We are talking about 15 feet tip-to-tip, basically the length of two ham stick antennas with the steel whips. So, yes, I have made a very compact form of a fan dipole, and I'm going to experiment with this on NVIS communications just to see what this thing can do. I haven't really fully tested them to my satisfaction yet, and believe me, as soon as I do, I'm going to come back on this net and basically let you folks know what's going on with that.
Yeah, your 15 feet of tip-to-tip length, as opposed to a full half-wave dipole, 132 feet, is almost a 9-to-1 physical compaction. And I'm not sure if it's a linear or square law phenomenon, but I know that your Q is going to go up at least linear, if not square law, and therefore you're going to become at least 9 times more narrow. But as long as you're willing to retune it, particularly if you've got a broadband antenna tuner and a very low-les piece of transmission line, I think you can use it over a significant bandwidth. Let's see what Gordon's got to say about all this. W2TTT, I wonder if you've ever done anything like this, Gordon. K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, I know that Gordon was probably mobile, and he's probably maybe out of range right now. Interesting. I think it's time you write this one up as an article, because I think other people are going to want to duplicate what you've done. From your point of view, Tim, is this an expensive antenna? What's the approximate number of dollars to do what you've done? You've now got a fan dipole 15 feet instead of 132 feet. And by the way, as far as nevus or non-nevus is concerned, that's strictly a function of altitude, not a function of size. You mount that antenna at the right altitude, and you're going to get the performance you want. I suspect that that antenna, even though it's small, can give you 90-some-odd% transmitting efficiency and receiving efficiency. You're going to have a hell of a lot of guys that are going to tell you, hey, it's smaller in size, it's going to have less area, and it's going to not receive as much signal. That is not true. You're ahead of the game on that one. So roughly how many dollars would it cost me to duplicate this? And consider writing an article on this one. I think you got a good one there, Tim. N2RDB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. I came in at slightly over $100 for the two brackets and the two pair of the two pair of hamstick antennas. That's a pair of 75 and a pair of 40 meter antennas, as I said. So it's actually four separate antennas we're talking about. Okay, the two brackets. And the piece of number 8 electrical wire was given to me by somebody in the maintenance department at work. And the aluminum bar that's basically holding the two brackets at a fixed distance from each other, approximately a foot apart, that was basically a piece of bar stock aluminum that was lying around work. And one of the machinists drilled some holes in it for me during my spare time. So basically a little over $100, which to me is less expensive than going out and buying the whole buddy pole outfit, which I was considering doing at one point. But I said to myself, let me just do this quick and dirty little trick and see if it works. N2RDB.
And W2TTT.
Yeah, you've got a winner there, Tim. That's a nice price. That's a nice size. And because of that size, some guys are going to be able to mount that up quite a bit higher than they would be the normal. Gordon, W2TTT, K2RIW, have you built something like that, Gordon?
Yeah, I did. I got a deal. John from Advanced Specialties at one point was misshipped some 12-meter sticks like the ones you're describing, the ones from Jetstream, et cetera, one with a ferrule that holds the whip, and I like those a lot better than the original hamstick design, by the way. And I encountered the same problem that he did with too much of the rod into the core. It does do some odd things at that point. But what I did with the 12-meter ones is I made a dipole and a rotatable dipole, and I found the longest possible whips. I found some other whips somewhere. And what I did was it wasn't quite about 22 megahertz. And because I wanted something that was above 20 meters. Well, it turns out that it works great on 20 meters. It works great on 15. It works great on 17. It works great on 12, and even on 10 meters works great too. So, you know, I use it with a remote tuner. I mean, I'm in a remote tuner, a tuner on the radio, coax fed, and I put a standard 8-turn loop ballon on it to make sure everything was working, and it worked great. By the way, I'm over here in Farmingdale on my way over back to New Jersey, so that's why I actually have a signal tonight. KJRAW and the net, W2TTC. Oh, one other thing. I paid $5 for the two stick.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Tim only timed out for the last 5 seconds, and he says his was $40. And he got it to work across all of those bands because of the antenna tuner. And I was hearing you so loud on the input, I was wondering, what in the world's going on with propagation now that I know that you're on the island of Long? Pretty good, Gordon. Looks like both Gordon and Tim have got a nice antenna style there by these hamsticks, as long as you're willing to live with the more narrow band or use a tuner. Good idea. I think you guys should write that one up, because I don't think I've seen anything quite like that. Doug was the next person. November 2 Echo Juliet. It's not K2EJ like Eric. November 2 Echo Juliet, K2RIW. Go ahead, Doug.
Correction.
Who said correction?
Yes, this is N2RDB. The $40 was for each pair of the hamsticks. With the mounting brackets, I came in at somewhere around 100 for the entire assembly.
Yeah, we knew that yours was 100, and Gordon's was 40. I don't think anybody got confused on that one, Tim. Doug, November 2, Echo Juliet, are you there? K2RIW.
K2MMY, I had a question.
Okay, looks like Doug's not there. And Ray, you're next, KC2, Mike Yankee, K2RAW. Take your time, Ray.
Okay, first I was trying to get in to ask this guy who made the dipole, what kind of gain is he getting on the 80 meters? Because I have a similar project, and that was going to be my question to Dick, is I'm not getting any gain. I'd like to know how much gain he's getting on 80. You don't have to tell me decibels, because I don't know that, but I mean, how well is it receiving on 80 with that configuration?
I think I understand the nature of your question, Ray, and you've fallen into a very typical trap that many guys on the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon will teach each other this false piece of information. All dipole-like antennas work well if and only if electronically they are resonated. A real dipole-like antenna, burn this into your brain, you resonate first, then you can radiate when you're transmitting. Yes, I'll admit that any old hunk of wire hooked onto the center conductor of your receiver, because receivers are so forgiving, will allow you to do medium good receiving, but you can't transmit through it. Once the antenna resonates, and once you've made it out of materials that are not getting hot with the RF, they're not converting your valuable RF energy into heat, they're really radiating that energy, that all dipoles have very close to the same gain, very close to the same effective capture area on receive. So the word gain on a dipole is only a function of whether or not you've got lossy components there. Let me drop. If you can put 100 watts into your dipole, key down for a couple of minutes, turn it off, walk over there and touch everything, and if everything is essentially cold to the touch, and you're not getting an extremely high standing wave ratio, that means that if that 100 watts went somewhere by conservation of energy, it had to go into space. And whether the dipole is 15 feet long or 132 feet long, within half a dB, it'll have the exact same gain, the exact same efficiency. After that, how well the dipole works is only after you've made it out of low-loss materials, and once you've resonated it, so it's giving you a reasonably good biswar with low-loss feed line, that how well it works is only a function of where you mounted it. Mounted 10 feet off the ground, where you have a near-vertical incident sky wave antenna, where the signal is being squirted straight up in the air, yeah, you're not going to talk to anybody very far away. So you mount that dipole, no matter how long it is, at the right altitude, and make sure it's not buried in some real wet trees, and it's not behind a mountain, it's not hidden by a bunch of tall buildings nearby, you're going to get full performance out of it. You cannot make the gain of a dipole go up and down just because you've changed the configuration of it, its physical length, the way you resonated it, or whatever. If it's made out of lossless materials, within half a dB, they must all have the same gain. I know that sounds kind of crazy, Ray, but I'm reasonably sure it's true. KC2MMY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I'm getting a little confused. I didn't really ask my question yet. I was trying to get an answer from the other gentleman on how good is his receiving gain on the 80-meter configuration that he built. And then I'm going to kind of ask my question. You kind of answered my question, but not really yet.
Okay. I'm telling you what it has to do. Now we're going to ask Tim to give us a testimonial. N2RDB, from when you built this hamstick dual band thing, let's just talk about 80 meters because that's what I think Ray wants to know about. Do you have reason to believe it's giving you essentially full performance for your altitude of mounting? I know that you're mounting it kind of low, therefore you've gotten the only Nevis operation, if I understand correctly, so therefore you may not have the ability to really answer Ray's implied question as to what gain it will give you if it was at the right altitude. But from what you see so far, do you believe you're getting, for its altitude, full performance on 80 meters, Tim? N2RDB, K2RIW?
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
From the receive point of view, from that standpoint, I've been pulling in stuff from all over the place. Transmitting, while I've made a few contacts, I haven't really spent that much time on the air with it, and I'm going to have to test it a little bit further before I can really give you a succinct answer on that. So I'm still in the testing procedure.
One quick question, Tim. Your 80-meter dual hamstick thing, how many feet off the ground is it up till now? Over to you, Tim.
About 8.5 feet above ground.
Wow. That's a Nevis antenna if ever there was one. So you're going to be getting a hell of a lot more transmitting performance if you give that some altitude. So at that altitude, no matter what the antenna is, if it's full wavelength, full half wavelength long, 132 feet, made out of gold-plated wire, silver-plated wire, only 8 feet off the ground, you're going to have a Nevis antenna no matter what you do. Over to you, Ray, with your real question. KC2MMY, K2RAW.
KC2QIQ, Dick, I have a comment on that also.
Let's go to Ray first. Go ahead, Ray.
Okay, Dick, here's what I got and my question. The question is the gain, but what I have was built a PVC, so basically a square, 5x8, and I have 40 meters worth of wire, that's 62 feet on each side, folded on itself, not a folded dipole, but, you know, folded foot and foot spaces, okay, so that you have 40 meters worth of wire on PVC. So it's a squished dipole, and it's got two ends to it, okay, and the positive end, and I just spoke to John yesterday, the positive end I loaded with a coil in the center to make it resonate on about 3.5 megahertz. Now, it resonates at 3.5 megahertz. It does work, but it has no gain. A 10-foot piece of wire straight out the window works better than this thing as far as gain. So I'm kind of annoyed at that, and I wanted to know why.
Okay, tremendous amounts of ambiguity in what you've given us so far, Ray. You have not drawn a mental picture. You've got PVC, you're winding a good number of feet of wire onto the PVC. You haven't said how. Is it spirally wound onto it, so it's a helical coil, so to speak? And if the PVC is 5x8, why is the PVC not one long strip? What does the 5x8 mean? So you haven't drawn a picture for us, Ray. KC2MMY, K2RIW.
Okay, picture two 5x8 squares with the center of the antenna right smack in the middle. There's a 5x8 square to the left and a 5x8 square to the right. Leaving the center conductor, the wire goes up and over a foot, down, and then over a foot, and then up again. So you're going in a zigzag type fashion on each side of the dipole. So you're squeezing 64 feet, I think it is, on each side of wire into an 8x5 on each side, double. That's what we got.
Okay. Are you copying somebody else's design, or is this just an experiment you decided to run? What's the origin of that design, Ray? Go ahead.
The origin is just the depths of my crazy mind. That thing was pretty resonant on about 40 meters because, again, we ran 40 meters worth of wire in that configuration. But I wanted resonant on 80 meters, so I decided to put a center-loaded coil that I tapped in a bunch of different places only on one side of the dipole. And I don't know if you can do that. You can tell me that, too. You can really just do that on one side of the dipole. So on the positive side of the dipole, it's got a coil, which brings the resonance of the whole tuned circuit down to 80 meters, but there's no gain. Bandwidth, I lost all the bandwidth. That's okay, because we can retune. I have an antenna at the other end, but it has no gain.
Okay, when you put a loading coil on only one side, you're really doing the equivalent electronically of feeding the dipole away from center, and there's nothing wrong with that. You can feed the dipole on the center, halfway from center to one end. And if you're smart enough with doing the right kind of impedance matching and balancing, you can feed it at the open end of the dipole itself. Just have no center insulator, just one continuous piece of wire. Now, I'm a little bit afraid you didn't use a balancing device. Therefore, your coax cable could be hot. You haven't mentioned that. And when you say it's got no gain, what's your definition of no gain? In the receive mode, you don't hear anything. Or when you transmit, they don't hear you. How far above the ground was it? Once you hit resonance by way of your loading coil, if at least at that one frequency you can get something like a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio or better, then the transmitter is going to be able to pump power into it. And as long as nothing melts when you run a key down with 100 watts for a couple of minutes, by definition, it's radiating it into space. It has no choice. By conservation of energy, you're either reflecting the energy, turning it into heat, or radiating into space. So if your antenna is mounted, let me pick a number, only 15 feet off the ground and 80 meters, then you're going to think it's low in gain. What's your definition of low in gain? When you transmit, nobody hears you, or when you listen, you don't hear them? Over to you, Doug. Ray, KC2MMY, K2RAW.
Okay, Dick, we're about 30 foot off the ground on a balcony outside, and I do get a 2-to-1 SWR on 3.5 megahertz, and my definition of gain is that it's less than the original antenna that I've been using, which is only a piece of wire about 20 foot long, you know, say 10 feet on each side of a dipole, you know, cut for, let's say, 20 meters or something, I don't know off the top of my head, and I just tune that with an antenna. That thing, so my gain is, what do you call, relative. That little regular dipole, just crummy piece of wire, has more gain, like a third more gain than this elaborate thing that I built.
Okay, if I took 10 feet of wire on each side as a, let me think now, it's a little bit long for a 10-meter dipole, but you're using it on 80 meters, and your antenna tuner must be working real hard to take that extremely short thing and give you a good standing wave ratio on 80 meters. And so I guess your definition now of low and gain is that you hear a stronger signal in the receive mode on the piece of wire with the antenna tuner, is what I think you're saying. And by the way, did the antenna tuner... this is a tough one. If the antenna tuner was going into a dummy load and that was your normal tuning settings of the tuning and loading control, and then if you have to go very far from that setting in order to feed either one of these antennas, that's one qualitative way of saying the antenna tuner is working real hard. The antenna itself is a very, very poor match. So when you say it's low in gain, I'm guessing you're saying the amount of S-meter deflection you get on reception, or when you transmit into it, what kind of signal reports you got.